Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Welcome to today's webinar on the subject of eStewards version 4.0. This webinar provides an overview of the changes between version 4.0 and version 3.1 for clients who are transitioning, as well as an overview of the standard for any clients who may be pursuing certification to eStewards for the first time. My name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Assistant Program Manager with PJR. Welcome. I have a brief agenda on this slide. The presentation will kick off with a little bit about PJR, who we are, what we do. We'll include some benefits and drivers associated with eSteward certification. I will provide an overview of the transition information and timeline for clients, again, who are certified to version 3.1 and transitioning to 4.0. I will highlight the key changes and then provide a little bit more detail in an overview of the standard itself. And I will close with an overview of the certification process for anyone, any clients or facilities pursuing certification for the first time. Perry Johnson Registrars is one of the leading registrars in the world. We have certified clients to a variety of standards globally. So this list is not all inclusive, but certainly gives you an idea of PJR's global presence as a certification body. And as I mentioned, we grant certifications for a variety of standards. We have accreditation to all of these standards. And again, this may not be an all-inclusive list, but certainly gives you an idea of the standards to which we audit. Obviously, eStewards is among those standards. The benefits of certification to eStewards vary by client, but certainly some common themes we can discuss here. The standard itself represents a commitment to preventing irresponsible or illegal handling of hazardous waste or electronic waste streams, as well as data security and protection, social responsibility, and environmental protection or conservation efforts. It also represents a reduction of environmental, occupational health and safety, data security, and social accountability risks as an organization goes through the process to implement and maintain a management system that follows the standard requirements. Additional benefits may include various business management drivers, such as improved public image, the ability to advertise the responsible management of electronics and electronic components. Holding an eSteward certification may provide a competitive advantage over competing entities. If you're trying to achieve a bid, for example, your eSteward certification may provide an advantage to your organization. And the standard also represents a framework for maintaining compliance with customer and regulatory requirements. We can use the Basel Convention requirements or regulations as an example of that. eStewards version 4.0 was published in February of last year. There is a guidance document that goes along with the standard, both of which can be obtained at the eStewards website. Version 4.0 of the standard is free compared to version 3.1 and previous versions. It also requires no end user agreement. This again is a change from version 3.1. And the reason for the change is that eStewards version 4.0 does not contain the proprietary ISO 14001 language as the previous versions of the standard did. So It's free. No end user agreement is required because the 14,001 verbiage is pulled out of there. The deadline to transition is quickly approaching. It's August 24th of 2021. On that date, any remaining version 3.1 certificates will be withdrawn. We are past the point where we can be conducting version 3.1 audits. So at this point, if you haven't already transitioned, your next audit will be a transition audit. This slide reflects the extension that was granted in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is the final deadline. And I want to note here, while we're talking about the transition expectations, that transition audits can be conducted remotely or virtually if a client organization is a good candidate for virtual auditing techniques, which is something that we evaluate on a case-by-case basis. PGR also issued its own transition plan. This was sent individually to all of our eStewards clients at the time that that was published. It's also found right on PGR's website. PGR communicated a deadline of June 1st of this year, which was our recommended deadline or the date by which your audit would have to take place for PGR to guarantee no lapse in certification. So at this point, if you haven't transitioned, there's the possibility that your version 4.0 certificate will not be granted before the before the deadline, and your 3.1 version certificate is withdrawn or invalidated, so you could have a lapse in certification there. Transition audits can occur during surveillance or recertification audits based on the client's preference. At this point, you're kind of at the mercy of where you fall in your audit cycle because you're down to the last couple of months of the transition timeline. I put that same information into a timeline for a visual representation. Again, at this point, we're nearing the end of the transition timeline. But again, the deadline to transition is August 24th, 2021. And that is the deadline by which your version 4.0 certificate needs to be issued to avoid a lapse in certification. That means not only does the audit need to take place by that date, all of the audit certification making decision-making activities need to be completed. So any corrective actions and NCRs from the audit need to be closed. The package needs to be reviewed internally by our technical committee. And the certificate draft approved by the client. I have another date on this timeline that's worth speaking about briefly as well. July 1st, 2022, eStewards version 4.0 requires NAAAA certification by that date. So once you have transitioned, that will be the next deadline you'll want to focus on, making sure if you're not already NAAAA certified, that you obtain that by July 1st of next year. At a high level, the key changes in version 4.0 compared to version 3.1, the standard is undoubtedly shorter with the removal of the ISO 14001 verbiage. We discussed that earlier, and as a reminder, the standard is available for free because of that. It's supposed to be easier to understand, less prescriptive overall, but it still maintains rigor in the primary or key areas within the standard. So controls for human health, exports, and data security. Version 4.0 incorporates the new Basel Convention trade rules and recent amendments. With the 14001 verbiage removed from the standard, it does require a separate ISO 14001 certification. Appendix C spells out the audit time calculations that we as a certification body are required to utilize. That's not something that PJR determines. Clients can expect an audit time increase by pulling the ISO 14001 certification out and dictating the audit time in Appendix C. In almost all, if not all cases, audit time will go up. I already discussed the NAID AAA certification requirement. So that is another significant change in version 4.0. eStewards did negotiate reduced fees for NAID for eStewards certified organizations. So when you do pursue NAID AAA certification, keep that in mind. I mentioned earlier as well, there is a guidance document available. You can obtain the most recent copy through eStewards' website. They will continue to revise that as necessary. So I would recommend obtaining that directly from the eStewards website. It has some clarifications or examples within it. There are an increased number of definitions of defined terms in version 4.0. We see some new terms such as materials of concern, QSCs or qualified smaller components. We also see some changed terminology. So HEW replaces HEE, which represents a subset of MOCs or materials of concern. Version 4.0 includes extended producer requirements, includes relaxed inventory requirements for those qualified smaller components, such as the ability to put them in lots rather than individual identifiers. It allows but regulates tolling activities within the standard and has added some noise monitoring requirements. In some cases or in some areas, annual sampling requirements is reduced. Outdated battery testing has been made more flexible. On-site downstream audits have been decreased to every 3 years. It was previously every two. There are additional requirements for verifying closure plans, financial instruments, and insurance checks when it comes to downstream accountability. And there are appendices on a variety of subjects, including standard implementation, rules for organizations, rules for certification bodies, and data security requirements, respectively. I'm not going to go through the terms and definitions in this webinar. I've included them in the slides. You can review those. They're found within the standard as well. We'll take some time now to go through the standard clause by clause. We're not going to review every clause, and not every clause will be represented on the slides. In many cases, there weren't significant changes to given sections. So I just want to highlight some of the areas where the more significant changes can be found within the standard. 4.1 covers the stewardship management system requirements. It specifies what needs to be included in the documented scope. And it also requires consideration of the precautionary principle, attempts to reduce negative electronic equipment lifecycle impacts, adherence to the waste management hierarchy wherever possible, and transparent handling of materials of concern throughout the recycling chain. The stewardship policy requirements are shortened with the 14,001 verbiage removed. It does specify the need for the policy to include items such as protection from harassment, restrictions around materials of concern, transboundary movements, and restrictions regarding prison operations, just as a couple examples. You can find those in 5.2. 5.3, the main change here is the requirement to establish teams for implementing and improving the stewardship management system, including a safety team, which is to include representation from all levels of the eStewards organization. Emphasis on all. In 6.1, we can find the requirement to plan and document tasks for addressing and monitoring risks and opportunities. In 6.1.1, there are no changes to the frequency or the scope of the risk assessment requirements. It's required initially and at least every 3 years, as well as in response to significant changes. This includes all operations under the facility's control or the organization's control, including ancillary sites. The section does specify items to be included or used as inputs for the risk assessment. This now includes potentially hazardous processing techniques utilized for electronic equipment processing and other hazardous substances that may be present. This section does not specify the qualifications for who would be conducting the risk assessment. So that's up to the organization to identify. 6.1.2 includes, again, specific items or concepts to be considered in regards to the stewardship aspect identification. And I've listed a couple examples on this slide. This section also requires documented information as evidence of criteria and as evidence of the results, as well as communication as relevant. We can find requirements surrounding international waste trade agreements and national laws in 6.1.3.1. The standard requires materials of concern to be treated as hazardous waste. It also requires that e-stewards organizations adhere to the Basel Convention's Article 4A Basel Ban Amendment, even if their country has not ratified it. The United States would be an example. If an e-stewards organization is subject to extended producer responsibility programs or is participating in those, the new section 6.1.3.2 would be relevant. The term is defined if you're unsure, and this section requires documented information. There are requirements for documented information for the organizations if they are participating in the extended producer responsibility programs. Those need to be made available upon request, and this section will not apply to all e-stewards organizations. So again, I recommend you take a close look at that term, that defined term, and go from there. 6.1.4 is another new section. It covers the performance verification expectations. It requires a documented plan for unannounced performance verification program inspections that may be conducted by e-stewards, and it specifies items to be included. And I've listed a couple of those there. This isn't new to the standard. It was in the appendices in 3.1, but now it has a home in the body of the standard itself. 6.1.4.1 covers the requirements to report data to the e-stewards database. This section relates to everything that needs to be reported through the e-stewards website. Further detail is located then in Appendix A to expand on this expectation. The requirement is for an initial report documenting the period between contracting with a CB certification body such as PJR and passing the stage one audit, so at least 3 months, and then by January 31st of each subsequent year to report the previous year's data. .3 is a new section. It covers the concept of planning for significant changes and implementing appropriate actions regarding those changes as they may impact the stewardship management system. So another term we see, if you're familiar with ISO 45001, would be management of change. 6.4 covers contingency planning or closure plans and financial surety expectations. So this specifies the information that needs to be documented and maintained within the contingency plan, including names and contact information for a third party entity or person holding the organization's financial instrument, ensuring that they have the authority to access any necessary site closure funds. Looking more closely at 6.4, we see a requirement in 6.4.2 that's been removed, which was the option for a corporate parent to hold the financial instrument. However, version 4.0 introduces an exemption that didn't previously exist. If the organization's financial instrument requirement is, or their closure costs, their cleanup costs are less than $5,000, they are exempted from the need to maintain a financial instrument. This is something that you would need to be able to prove or provide evidence to your auditor to justify that the closure costs are less than $5,000. No significant changes here. We discussed earlier the need for the policy to include protection from harassment. The internal communication requirements in 7.4.2 also require communication without fear of reprisal. External communication requires communication where relevant, that the controls be in place. So emergency response protocols, security requirements being communicated to contractors and visitors alike. It also specifies what information needs to be confidentially communicated to upstream customers and the eStewards program administrator. And there are a variety of examples for this. I've included some, again, in my slide as examples. The documented information section allows the organization to set up their documents in a way that makes sense for them as an organization. They can combine or separate documentation requirements as they deem fit, as long as the minimum documentation information requirements are met. However, there are three exceptions. They need to be separated and maintained as individual documents to ensure easy and prompt access. Those include the closure plan, the emergency preparedness and response plan, and the downstream disposition chart. So those would be the three exceptions to the ability of the organization to set up the documentation however they feel is appropriate. Documented information needs to be maintained for at least 5 years unless a longer retention period is specified. No significant changes in terms of operational controls. However, there's a requirement that the hierarchy of controls be utilized where applicable. The only change worth mentioning in 8.2 is that annual drills are required for relevant types of emergencies. 8.3 covers the industrial hygiene program. Is required to address hazards of an airborne, ergonomic, noise, and or physical nature. It also requires prevention of hazard migration where that may be applicable. 8.3.1 goes into more detail regarding potentially hazardous processing technologies. It specifies additional items to be included in the industrial hygiene program for organizations that use or utilize one or more PHPT. So you need to review the standard and the table to understand whether you, if you don't already know, whether you are utilizing as an organization any PHPTs. And as, if you identify that you are using at least one, you would refer to section 8.3.1 to understand what additional requirements would be imposed on your industrial hygiene program. Additional detail is also found in Appendix A. 8.4.1 specifies topics or information to be determined and planned by the organization, with adequate documented information required as evidence of both having determined a plan for the management of electronic equipment, as well as implementing that plan. So you need documented information of the determination and the implementation to meet the standard requirements here. 8.4.2 covers requirements for operational controls regarding the processing of electronic equipment, which includes materials of concern. There's a table in this section that relates to mechanical processing restrictions unless an organization were using a closed system technology. Overall, this section is less prescriptive. 8.4.3 covers packaging, storing, and transportation requirements for all electronic equipment under its control. Some examples include not storing materials of concern for more than 1 year after receipt, ensuring adequate vehicle and driver safety records for transporters and carriers, having a stacking limit of no more than two Gaylords or Super Sacks. Those are just a couple examples. Tolling operations are covered in a new section in 8.4.4. This section regulates tolling processes, again, if they apply to a given e-stewards organization. This will not apply to all organizations certified to e-stewards. Examples include communication expectations, contract stipulations, annulment of tolling contracts if violations are identified, just to name a few examples. Again, here, documented information is required as evidence of meeting the requirements in this clause. 8.4.5 addresses that prison operations are not permitted unless the e-stewards organization has obtained written approval from the e-stewards program administrator and meets criteria specified in 8.4.5. Again, this won't apply to all organizations, so instead of going through 8.4.5 in more detail, I'll just refer you to that section of the standard if it applies to you. There are no changes to the intent of 8.5 in regards to reuse and refurbishment of electronic equipment. This section prohibits the sale, transfer, or donation of non-sanitized electronic equipment unless it's to a NADE AAA certified IDP, except in tolling operations or where non-sanitized electronic equipment is sent back to its original owner. Refurbishment and or repair can only be outsourced to immediate downstream processors, except for ink and toner remanufacturing, which can go one tier further. Direct reuse electronic equipment must be found fully functional, except for those shipments to IDPs for refurb or repair. No significant changes to the intent in 8.5.1. We see testing requirements specified here. There are some changes in this section, including battery testing criteria. So if you're doing the testing, you'll take a close look at this section. Table 3 constitutes exceptions to full functionality testing, including a small amount of donations or sales of unusual equipment, as well as the removal of untested unit sale or donation for workers. So that's something that was previously allowed that has been removed. 8.5.2 covers the identifying information for electronic equipment. The criteria or identification inclusions are specified in 8.5.2. This is also where we see the simplified inventory requirements for qualified smaller components that I alluded to earlier. So, for example, this allows an organization to put QSCs in lots rather than imposing the need to label or identify each individual item. And that is only for qualified smaller components. So again, take a close look at that definition in the standard. 8.5.2.1 specifies minimum information to be included on shipping documentation for all sales and transfers, and that needs to be accessible without the need for unpacking the shipment. So you need to be able to get to that without unpacking. Appendix A includes a declaration or equivalent that's to be used for applicable transboundary shipments. The section also requires accessibility and availability of identifying information for all shipments other than qualified smaller components, such as itemized packing lists, an internet link kept active, etc. 8.5.3 is shorter and less prescriptive overall in terms of reuse markets. I do just want to mention the last bullet point here that stipulates buyer information is not required if the organization can show evidence that shipments were tested to be fully functional and were sold for at least 3 times the scrap rate. So if you're maintaining that evidence and it is available to the auditor, then the buyer information does not need to be maintained. 8.6.1 specifies management criteria for materials of concern and references Appendix A again. This also requires written proof or justification for meeting the specified criteria to be provided to the certification body as well as the eStewards program administrator before using a conditionally allowable option. On the other hand, 8.6.2 covers alternative uses, which require written approval from the eStewards program administrator prior to utilizing the alternative process. And in 8.6.2, you find those specific items to be included in the approval request, the documentation requirements that go hand in hand with this expectation, things like that. 8.7 covers control of transboundary movement. Whole electronic equipment is to be treated as hazardous electronic waste unless the shipment provides documented evidence proving otherwise. It also requires written notification and competent authority consent prior to material of concern transboundary movement whenever countries involved are not Basel Convention parties or covered by their own multilateral trade agreement. So the United States is not a party member. We do have a bilateral agreement with Canada, for example. 8.7.1 covers exemptions from transboundary movement controls for materials of concern. So any exceptions would be found here, such as new parts or devices that are purchased under warranty, clean glass cullet approved as feedstock, things like that. 8.7.2 covers transboundary movement of used electronic equipment for repair or refurb. Labeling and declaration requirements are found in 8.5.2.1 as well as Appendix A for any exports for refurb or repair. Again, remember that has to go to the IDP and no further than that one tier. 8.7.3 covers the same only for direct reuse. So here again, we see references to 8.5.2.1 and Appendix A, and this is when electronic equipment is exported for direct reuse. It has to be fully functional and it can't be recycled or disposed of. It has to have an established resale market and meet some of the other requirements in 8.7.3. 8.8 covers downstream accountability. In terms of significant changes, there is a requirement to reevaluate a downstream processor upon significant changes within a timely manner. This section also still applies even if electronic equipment is directly shipped from the customer to the IDP. instead of first coming to the organization certified to e-steward. So whether the material passes through the organization's facility or they just assume control and ship it directly to the customer, it doesn't make a difference. Downstream accountability requirements still apply. 8.8.1 covers the downstream disposition chart. There are no significant changes here. Just a note that organizations certified to e-stewards cannot utilize any downstream processors within their recycling chain that have lost e-stewards certification in response to a critical nonconformity until the certificate is reinstated. So that's one important thing to note. 8.8.2 requires attainment of support documentation and approval for downstream providers as well as intermediaries within the entire recycling chain according to those requirements in 8.8.2. So not only are you doing downstream due diligence on the immediate downstream processor, if there are additional entities within the recycling chain, documentation to support the downstream accountability and the approval needs to be maintained to meet this requirement. Has several subclauses that go into the different downstream accountability expectations. We're not going to go through these in a ton of detail, but you can see certainly some of the highlights in the slides. 8.8.2.1 covers the initial approval prior to that first shipment. You need to be able to demonstrate that they were approved prior to shipping them any material, any electronic equipment or hazardous electronic waste. There are additional things to verify if the downstream processor is not e-stewards certified. Even after that initial approval, subsequent annual reevaluation is required. So we're looking to see that you've identified what those criteria will be. Desk audits are required initially, again, prior to shipment, as well as subsequently on an annual basis. The exclusion to that would be final disposal facilities. On-site audits are required in some cases. That's covered in 8.8.2.3. It's not required if the IDP is e-stewards, a final disposal facility, or an end processor who is licensed and permitted and located in an OECD country. So unless it meets one of those requirements, an on-site audit is required. That's required initially prior to shipment, as well as every 3 years and upon significant change. I mentioned earlier that downstream accountability or due diligence now also includes the need to review closure plans and financial surety evidence. Requires a written contract or agreement or some type of equivalent control containing specified information for all HEWs and PCMs if they're not e-stewards certified or a final disposal facility or an end processor in an OECD country like we talked about in the previous slide. 8.8.2.6 also requires annual sampling of shipments between each IDP and the next non-e-stewards downstream processor. 8.9 covers data security. This section references Appendix D for those organizations who are not yet NAID AAA certified. So again, the deadline to obtain NAID AAA certification for e-stewards version 4.0 organizations is July 1st of 2022. Appendix D contains all of the data security requirements to which an e-stewards organization not AAA certified is audited against. Once NAID AAA certification is obtained, then Appendix D no longer applies, and the NAID AAA certification satisfies the data security requirements for that organization. 8.9 changes in terms of performance evaluation, monitoring, measurement, things like that. The only change worth noting in terms of evaluation of compliance is a minimum frequency for those evaluations defined as annual in version 4.0. 9.1.4 requires corrective actions if the material balance accounting has a final discrepancy of more than 5%. Specifies inputs and outputs for management review. Some changes there, nothing significant. Appendix A, as I already mentioned throughout the presentation, includes additional detail and additional criteria for implementing certain parts of the standard. So this is where we find the database reporting requirements, where we find the potentially hazardous processing technologies, testing requirements, the final disposition table, transboundary shipment declaration template, things like that. Appendix B houses the administrative criteria for e-stewards organizations. So this is information that's relevant to the client organizations, eligibility details, scope requirements, covering things like ancillary sites, parent companies, subsidiaries, etc., applications and contracts, logo usage, critical nonconformities, the performance verification inspections, all that good stuff. Appendix B requires a new license agreement be obtained if the organization is purchased by another entity or there is some type of change in ownership. It also requires that certified organizations notify their CB and the e-stewards program administrator of significant changes affecting conformity to the standard within 15 business days. So these significant changes, again, we've used that term throughout the presentation, so you might want to refer to the definition of that term, but the significant changes need to be communicated in a timely manner. They can affect a variety of things, including audit time or the need for additional auditing. So it is not appropriate to wait until your next audit, you know, 3, 6, 9 months later to bring it to the certification body or the auditor's attention. This is something that needs to be reported in real time. Appendix C, on the other hand, houses administrative criteria or requirements for the certification bodies and the accreditation bodies to follow. So PJR, ANAB, those types of entities, this section is for them. But it can be helpful to review the requirements and see some of the requirements that the certification body is held to, for example. This is also where you find the audit time specifications. As I mentioned earlier, audit time is dictated to be calculated a certain way, especially now that ISO 14001 certification has been separated out from the e-stewards certificate, and the audit time needs to be calculated according to Appendix C. We spoke about Appendix D earlier. This is where we find specifics related to data security. There are a whole host of requirements here. If you're not already NAID AAA certified, take a close look at Appendix D. There is applicable regulatory requirements here, communication of risk, a whole bunch of security controls or processes. It covers the methods for sanitization and verification of effectiveness, a variety of controls for security breaches or related incidents as well. Appendix D applies, as a reminder, until a NAID AAA certification is obtained, and there is a deadline to obtain that for e-stewards version 4.0 certified organizations. Okay. So I'm also going to spend a couple minutes going over the certification process. So this, instead of a transition, this would be for a client organization pursuing certification for the first time, give you an idea of what that process looks like. One of the first steps is always to obtain a copy of the standard to which you're looking to be certified. so you can get familiar with the requirements and have that as a reference. It's really important. You would then establish stewardship management system documentation to meet the standard requirements. You would conduct any training that's necessary to meet the management system requirements. You would implement the requirements found throughout the documentation you established and the standard requirements, including conducting an internal audit, conducting a compliance evaluation, and conducting a full system review or a management review. It's important to conduct the management review after the internal audit, as the internal audit results are an important input to the management review discussion. You'll also need a contract with a certification body or a CB such as PJR to conduct those audits. You will then complete the audit in two stages. Stage one and stage two represent the registration audit process together. We'll talk about that in a moment. Any nonconformities that result from the stage two audit do need to be resolved before a certificate can be issued. The stage one audit focuses on the documentation framework to make sure that the organization is ready for their stage two audit. The stage two audit is a full system audit. It includes sampling of all of the processes, all of the shifts, to get a sense of the effectiveness of the implementation of the system. Has it been implemented effectively, and is it effectively meeting the requirements of the standard? After the certificate is issued, so you complete your stage two audit, you resolve any nonconformities that were issued through the corrective action process, and the certificate is issued, now you enter into the surveillance cycle. So the certificate is good for 3 years, which means those following 2 years represent surveillance audits. These can be semi-annual or annual, depending on your contract. And these represent partial system audits, not as long as a stage two in most cases, and they do not require sampling of all the processes. Roughly half would be reviewed. There are standard requirements that are reviewed or sampled at every audit, but the operational processes would be roughly half. The third year of the three-year cycle represents the recertification audit, which for all intents and purposes is very much like the stage two. It covers all of the processes, all of the shifts, and once any nonconformities are resolved, results in the issuance of a certificate to start that three-year cycle over once again. Since we are recording this presentation for future viewing, we're not taking any questions today. However, I've included contact information on this last slide. My name is Austin Matthews. I'm the EHS Assistant Program Manager with PJR. I can be contacted via phone or email. It's the main PJR number. They can transfer you to my extension, or again, you can contact me via email. I've also included the sales department phone number if you are a new client looking for a quote to pursue certification with PJR. Stacey DeSantis has recently departed, so I do need to update this slide. However, again, the main phone number for PJR can be utilized to contact members of the EHS team to answer e-stewards questions, which would most likely come again to me. My name is Austin. So feel free to reach out if you do have any questions. If you have already transitioned, I hope this is helpful in your ongoing continual improvement efforts. If you have your transition audit coming up, I hope this information is helpful in preparing for your audit. And again, if you're a new client pursuing certification for the first time, I hope this is helpful. Feel free to reach out with any questions. And if your transition audit is coming up, good luck. Thanks and have a great day.